From Habitual to Awakened Living is the first in the series Resetting the Mind. Let us start by examining habitual living and see if it is possible to live in a better way so that our very lives become the means to lasting peace, joy, inner blossoming, and spiritual ascent. Friends, today let us look at four things. Habitual living, or the way of living we are accustomed to. Then let's look at the I fabric, or ego. This I fabric, or ego, is the seed of habitual living, it is what sustains habitual living, and it is what strengthens by habitual living. Let us then turn our attention to the past and see if there are ways and means in the past that can enrich us in the present and bring these into the present so that we can go from habitual living to awakened living. When what to do becomes more important than how to be, we become habitual. Life reflects habit, as getting more has become a cookie-cutting exercise. This brings in a regression, increases problems, worries, and dissatisfaction. Before considering a better way, let us examine our role in these three: problems, dissatisfaction, and worries. Our problems have nothing to do with people, conditions, or things outside. Our problems are our reactions to reality, people, conditions, and things just as they are. Friends, let us have a closer look at it. What are our problems? What do we think about? What do we worry about? It's quite simple. One of two things. What I want is not happening, and what I do not want or prefer is happening. What I would like to see is not here, and what I would not like to see is here to stay. There's only one little thing in the middle of all of this, that I. And it seems if we can dispense that I, it feels if we can dispense with that I, it might also dispense with the problem. Now, how does one turn away from one's own reactions, one's own habits, and from one's own self-centeredness finally? Dissatisfaction comes from the non-acceptance of things as they are, and it is the very seed of worrying which follows. There is a difference between making or doing something better and being dissatisfied with what actually is. Let's go back to what we were talking about earlier. Our problems are centered around what I like or what I would like or what I would prefer is not happening, and what I don't like or don't prefer is happening. So it seems easier, as we mentioned, to figure out what to do about that I that likes or dislikes. We can deal with things, but do we need to include our likes and dislikes as part of dealing with things or improving upon things? You see something and it looks like it can be made better or it could be better, simply do it with all of your attention and all of your heart. My friends, why should a defect in something or seeing a defect or fault in something drive my effort to improve it? When I do that, the feeling of dissatisfaction or complaint or fault finding resides in me, and it seems that I have one step backward while I am trying to move forward. Why should a defect drive my effort to do something good instead of just a positive feeling? See it, look at it with all of your attention, and make it good. When there are sound feelings to do more or better, there is no room at all for dissatisfaction. when one does not accept things as they are and thinks, that is the key word, thinks, of ways to change what actually is, worrying happens. Look, my friends, let things be as they are. Everything, whether it's this way, that way, or crooked, is an opportunity to do something good. What is there to think about what is or what might be? Let it unfold and look at it. If it's okay, move on. And if it's not, do something good. Worrying doesn't change a thing. And we always worry about things that could be. Well, they may never be. So worry comes from dissatisfaction, and dissatisfaction comes from the perception of a problem with things. These three are interlinked with each other. One worries because one may not be able to change what is, or there may be resistance. We never worry about real or actual situations. When something happens, we deal with it. It requires a response. If there is a fire or a flat tire, you deal with it, but there's no end to worrying. When one worries, thought moves amidst thought. Without needing a situation, this whole thing is a mental operation within our own mind, and the ego personality assumes selfhood. When I worry, something in me worries about something in me, because there is no situation. It hasn't happened. There's nothing outside. We can think we're worrying about something out there, but it hasn't happened. So thought that seems to be me or my ego personality is worrying about a situation which is also me. And there's a sort of splitting within the psyche or the mind, and I undergo this whole thing, which is absolutely unnecessary. My problems, dissatisfaction, and worries are mine only, mine alone. They're all connected to me, my problems, my dissatisfaction, my worries, and they're all experienced in me. If the effects, which are these three, problems, worries, and dissatisfaction, are in me, the cause must be in me as well. The cause cannot be separated from the effect. The seed itself grows to be a tree. This whole operation is happening in me only. The question is, why does this happen? And what can I do about it? When the inner conditioning identifies itself completely with the ego personality, the cycle of worry feeds on itself. The inner world dictates the value of things outside and one's responses to them. At that point, life is completely mechanical or habitual. Though it may seem intelligent, though it may seem like we're making decisions, those decisions are not being made by what actually is, but our attitude towards them. Our world gets smaller and smaller as we look at the inner world more and the outer world less. One's innate wisdom and goodness are eclipsed, and mechanicalness comes in the front seat, or life becomes more mechanical. How we do things, how we live, and who we are become unimportant. What we do, the what reigns, and the what becomes supremely important. We've gone through habitual living and seen that the hub of it, or the I fabric, or ego, is what needs to be examined and gotten rid of. The content of our problems, worries, and dissatisfaction is thought. It is the stuff that our problems, worries, and dissatisfaction is made of. These thoughts weave themselves into a fabric in which the sense of self gets inextricably identified. Thought's web is very much like the spider's web. The spider's web is emitted and sustained by the spider, Similarly, thought weaves a web for itself, of itself, and within itself. This inner world of I, my friends, is a false self, as we are aware of it. Not only am I aware of something that I am dissatisfied with or have a problem with or worry about, but I am also aware of that which worries about. Who is that? That which is an object can never be a subject. When the fabric of thought starts shaping what one perceives or thinks, that is conditioning. Say someone rubbed you wrong yesterday, and today you happen to see that person coming towards you. The feeling from yesterday starts shaping what you see today and prompting, oh, that person is coming. But see, that person is not coming. This person is coming. And this person may be coming to apologize or make amends or whatever. But that feeling from yesterday insists that person is coming. So when something is perceived, these modifications or thought fabric tell you what they are based on your previous feeling towards it. When this happens, the whole mind is not allowed to come into play. The whole mind is the undivided mind, the mind that can see things just as they are. But that little strand of feeling from yesterday that is anchored to your personality, just that little thought fabric insists that this is that, or that is this. Everything in your life today, the state of your body, whether healthy or sick, the state of your fortune, is entirely conditioned by the thoughts and feelings you have entertained in the past. On the same token, the conditions of your life tomorrow will be entirely conditioned by the thoughts and feelings that you choose to entertain from now on. So naturally, one would ask this question: what makes conditioning so powerful? And a to-the-point answer would be, you allow it to be so. The mind has become what it is because of misuse, and it must be set right by proper use. No amount of threatening, coercion, suppression is going to work on the mind at all. If we empower a better way to live that is joy-giving, happy, purposeful, focused, that just gives you more, it will naturally respond to life, and the old ways will weaken by disuse. The mind is very plastic, my friends. It has become this way, and it can be made a new way. The great masters found this better way to live. Sages and saints have gifted us the results of their search for truth. And though the way we live has changed, why we live has not. Why are we here? What is it to be attained? How do we attain it? Can this be done while still undergoing life's experiences? And is all of this possible today? Life is a means for inner purification and an opportunity to realize our true nature. Just like going on a long journey, it is helpful if we have mile markers to know we're on track. Similarly, stages of life were major milestones for growth and evolution. And upbringing and education is where it first started, and these were imparted on the foundation of inner cultivation. The what to do, my friends, was always driven by who we are in our essential nature, and therefore how to be. Now, let us get a little more nitty-gritty and down to brass tacks on the things the ancients knew that would be very helpful to us today. First of all, that there could not be two existences, mine and yours and others, as each would have its own inner intelligence, and on a cosmic level, this would be chaos. If there is one infinite, one existence, we cannot be outside that. So we cannot be outside this absolute or God. Therefore, the goal of life must be to realize our true nature or our inseparability from self or God. For this, there must be a more comprehensive way to live where life and practice work together towards inner purification. Because, my friends, it's not enough to know this intellectually and to say, aha, it makes sense. The actualizing of this truth is the main focus of this journey we call life. Before we go any further, my friends, a couple cursory notes on the last slide. It was said, the sages laid out that the goal of life is God realization, or purification of one's mind, one's self, so that one's true nature can be seen directly. Now, one may or may not have that as their own goal. That doesn't matter. But what is important is to find a way right now to live without hurt or hurting. Can we find a way by which the mind responds to life naturally, smoothly, efficiently, joyfully, and without all this chaos? That, my friends, lies in the path of that lofty goal. For this, the sages laid out stages of life. Upbringing and education were imparted on the foundation of inner cultivation. Before they learnt what to do, their vocation or their trade or whatever they would be doing, they learnt how to be and how to interact with one another, not just from a moral standpoint or ethical standpoint, but more closer towards their inner nature, because this was not something they were doing to conform to a standard. They were taught, if this is the goal, then actualizing of the goal is why we do things. And why we do things has that potential of discovery. Then, experiences for family and career came along, and these allow one to grow further if one keeps cultivation in mind. See, my friends, it's difficult to fight with one another if you realize that the reason for things is self-improvement, self-unfoldment, and things of that nature, because you will always find a way. And if that is lost sight of, then the littlest things will be reasons to quarrel or not get along. Having gone through the necessary experiences, one finds a way to live while being inwardly freer and allows more attention towards pursuit of the truth. When there is inner purity, sufficient inner purity and momentum, it then becomes natural to pursue realization of the truth with all one's being. Now, these four stages are not solid watertight compartments that are dictated this by this year, that by that year, because not only is each person different, but their conditions are different. So their nature is different and their conditions were different. But there was a general flow that the sages understood was helpful, so our life, right from its formative years of upbringing, education, the experiences of home and family and career, and then towards the pursuit of the truth, was flowing without resistance or without losing its way. The most important of all the four stages, my friends, was the bridge, upbringing and education. There are laws of the mind just like there are laws in nature. Before you give something that, say, a precision instrument to somebody, it would be useful to know how to use that. Before a knife is given in someone's hands, it's useful for them to understand that the blade end cuts, and with the handle, one can do things. So similarly, the mind has its own laws. And it is in those early years where they learnt about their minds, their own self. So later, they didn't succumb to temptations and weaknesses, and they had self-control naturally, not by suppression, but by understanding. That led to a flowering of natural goodness. Natural or innate goodness is not goodness that is put on. It is just there, my friends, just like a rose is fragrant without doing anything, and the sun is luminous and warm without doing anything. Why? Because that's its nature. Similarly, we have goodness within us that could be unfolded and should be unfolded. And it was those early formative years where they had their upbringing and education where that was done. Because if natural goodness is lost, the outer harnesses the inner, and that can never be good. What do we mean by this? Today, you see an emphasis on the what and on the outer. There's a good opportunity. Aha, there's a good opportunity. Let me take advantage. Or there's a sale. Let me take advantage of the sale and let me pick up the items that I need or as many as I can get. But we may not consider the others. We may not consider. And so in our taking care of our personal interests becomes natural. The outer seems to govern or harness the inner. I see an opportunity, I bring my talents out to harness the opportunity. But this way of thinking and functioning and living was quite different when they were brought up in this old system. They learned for the inner, their core values, their natural goodness to respond to the outer. If something was seen, do I need it or do I not need it? And so one never got carried away and had to go about reclaiming themselves or resetting the minds as we have gone, we have started or embarked upon today. And so these lessons that were learned from the past are critically important. The great masters knew that if the how to be is not cultivated, the what to do will always be an expression of self-centeredness. And this could never be good for society or the individual. So now to the present. Some important things in a time long gone. The old system now is long gone, but its principles are sound, as they were not rooted in a particular time or in social customs. When the principles are beyond time, the means are beyond time as well. And they will work today just as they did in days gone by. Let us have a look at how we can make this work for us today. The most important thing is wanting to change. Not wanting to change things, but wanting to change ourselves. My friends, we started today by looking at our problems, our dissatisfaction, and our worries. And we saw that they were all centered in the I. My problems, my dissatisfaction, my worries. And rather than deal with the external every time it occurs, which is a never-ending battle, as you and me know, and damage control at best, why not get to the root of it, the I that would rather have things one way and not another way? Can we find a way to live without that I? Can life still go on along with my work and family and everything else without that I? Is that I so critical that it cannot be dispensed with? And if it can be, what is the means? So to want to change fundamentally is critical, and we have to each come to that juncture on our own. Wanting to change, not this or that, but change in such a fundamental way that one is ready to shed the real causes of all our ills of life, just as eagerly as a snake is to shed its slough. See, my friends, the snake does not begin till the old skin begins to prick at it a little bit, but waiting to hurt is optional. though the newly forming delicate skin is right beneath. It then finds a way to resolve it. Can I deal with both these skins, the inner and the outer, sort of a live and let live way? But when that is found to be not tenable, it gets enthusiastic about shedding its old and goes directly into action. This is what is needed, my friends. It is essential to have a definite aim or purpose in life. It is this purpose that guides all of our actions, not just the what to do, but the how to do and how to be. And it's up to each one to decide how high they set the threshold of this definite aim or purpose. And upbringing, education, home, career, and family life, all these are good, my friends, but they're in time process. There should be a quest for simplification. Can I find a way to live after having gone through the experiences where I'm inwardly free? And when I feel that inward freedom, can I with that pursue the truth so that experience can be my fulfillment? Now we come a little bit more down to brass tacks. And this and the next three slides, my friends, are going to be important because we've started together on this journey of finding a way to live that is beyond the mundane, beyond mechanical living, beyond habitual living, and awakened living. Can one live without hurt and without hurting? And that is our focus in these sessions. Without the upbringing and education that was based on inner cultivation, we get off to a sort of wobbly start. Because the emphasis is on the what. Opportunities and situations are needed to harness talent and goodness, whereas it should be the other way around. This inner goodness should look for ways to bring that out. It should look for ways to be useful to others in society also, aside from taking care of one's own interests. This loosens the heart of its selfishness. So as there was an upbringing in education, naturally, it transitioned into home and career. And I call it home and career and not the householder path or things like that, because home is a little bit more involved. It includes things that one would like to have and relationships and also a career to fit in with that. But still, these two or in these two, the upbringing and education and home and career, the emphasis is from the who to the what. I would like to have this experience or go through this, and it's still a little bit of the I. And this is natural, my friends, because that momentum needs to be understood. But there is an understanding of this I that would like to have this home and this family and this career and this promotion or whatever, then one begins looking, can it not be done in a better way? Whereas the what becomes a way to cultivate the who. Can I not do things without losing myself? Can I not do things with increasing my goodness? Can I not live in such a way to unfold beauty in myself? But all this takes time. It takes maturing. So we go from upbringing and education for an urge to experience home, career, and everything that comes with it. But the emphasis is still from the I to the what. And gradually that gets turned around. And this is what they learned in the early years, is how to turn the car around and come back home and not to get lost in what we call the race of life. So the emphasis shifts from the who to what, turning around, to the what to who. Can I find a better way of doing things while I'm still dealing with home, career, enjoying things, and etc. So they found a simpler way, and this led to simplification of themselves, which naturally reflected in their lifestyle, and it brought about an inner freedom. This, my friends, was critical to have psychological freedom so that one could dedicate effort towards realization of the truth or the self, or you can just call it higher pursuits. But without being psychologically free, one cannot free oneself physically, because that would just be suppression. That would just be denial, and the mind would bounce right back. So it takes living in wisdom to be able to enter this third stage of simplification, which brings inner freedom and psychological freedom. And that naturally reflects in a simpler life without trying to make life simple cosmetically. And then comes a natural urge to know the truth, because one has the leisure, one has the freedom, and one is intrinsically simple, and one's life reflects that also. Friends, just talking about these doesn't do much. There must be some tangible take-home, something we can do right now, today itself, to start bringing these into life. So for this, let's look at the old system, which is gone, but let's look at those essentials towards inner growth that we can reflect in our lives today, and how to do this. And this is the challenge before us. So what have we actually lost? The foundation of self-knowledge, which started out with upbringing and education. That foundation of self-knowledge. Now, these are things that we're going to have to bring into our life so we can guide it in an awakened and purposeful manner. Two, how to live without hurting oneself or others, that is, without the ego. Is the I so very necessary in life beyond just an identity? Well, my name is Swami so-and-so, or John, Bob, Jill, or whatever it is. But beyond that, where it makes me feel different from you, a sense of identity that makes me stand apart from you and vie and compete with you and either hurt or protect myself. So can I live without hurting myself or others and without this ego? Can that name just be a name tag? Can I live through that common with you, one with you? Three, how to do what needs to be done because it needs to be done. The outer should never harness the inner, and opportunity should never harness talent. Goodness inside and talent should look for a way to fulfill itself. Now that's fulfillment, when we look for things to do, not because it's in our best interest, not because it's an opportunity, not because it's worth it, but because it's a good thing. I see a glass bottle on the road, pick it up. Why? It's the right thing to do. So can we do what needs to be done because it needs to be done? No big fanfare, no big halo, nothing like that. It's just a good thing to do. Four, how to go through life's experiences while getting closer to our true sense of self, so that that self-knowledge can go beyond intellectual into actualization. Is there a way to live where life itself can be a process of unfolding the divinity within? Five, not getting stuck at the second stage by habitual living, which is the stage of experiences, and we called it home and career. Can we move without getting stuck there? Because if we get stuck there, sure, but more and better, my friends, is cookie cutting by any definition. And cookie cutting must lead to regression and stagnation. Six, the ability to transition towards psychological disentanglement without altering the external much, at least initially. Can I, or can one, right where one is, as they go through experiences, be free of them by understanding them? When you've experienced status and power and success and affluence, or whatever it is, position, call it whatever you acclaim, through any of these, can we move through them, understanding them, without beginning to like them so much that we stay there and demand more? without getting addicted to them, without getting fixated with them. And when that happens, there is psychological disentanglement. We've had experiences, but now these factors, call it success, name, fame, recognition, or whatever, are not what draws us, are not what pulls us. We learn how to do things because they need to be done, and we learn what's the joys of simplification. One's aspiration for the higher gains momentum, and the new inner, the freer inner, adjusts the outer naturally. So there isn't any sense of suppression or jagged edges or sudden stops or forcing. These were the important lessons and important factors that have been lost. A foundation of self-knowledge, knowing how to live without hurting oneself or others, knowing how to do what needs to be done because it needs to be done, doing things in a way that unfolds the true being or true self or true divine nature, or just see goodness, innate goodness. Not getting stuck at the second stage, which is basically the stage of experience through this world, but learning through it so one can be psychologically free and then move towards the truth. Can we bring these major factors and points? These are the things that we need to bring into our life to reset the mind, to make it healthy. How to do it is the challenge before us. The means must reflect the aim, not only in good measure, but in full measure, my friends. So the take home today, we're going to talk more on life. What can we take from this, and how can we actualize those ingredients that are missing? How can we bring those into our life? We'll get into spiritual practice and things of that nature, which will help us a little bit later as we go along. But today we are concerned with the transition from mundane or routine or mechanical living or habitual living to an awakened life. The first thing is, do one thing at one time with all of your heart, your mind, your soul, and your body. Consider no work better than the other. Every work is an opportunity to gather the rays of the mind if we do it with all of our heart. And also, my friends, this removes selectiveness from our mind, because our mind would rather do that, say, than be cleaning something or doing some chore. We would rather do something even holy or spiritual or whatever you call it. But when we learn to do everything, sweeping the floor, taking out the garbage, everything, with all of our heart and being, we begin to see the ego rise up. I would rather be doing this. And we continue to do what we are doing with all of our heart and being. The momentum of the ego starts weakening, and we begin to reclaim ourselves in gaining the inner strength to channel the energy without being bullied by the ego. A very simple principle, my friends, but it does wonders in bringing about this reset. And every time we come together, we're going to talk about a few things, and towards the end, we are going to have these take-homes, which are actual things that we can and should practice now, here and now, not waiting for tomorrow or not needing any equipment as such. 2, include thought in the field of observation. The outer, my friends, is not seen in the outer. Whatever is out there, including the slide that you're looking at, is being seen inside you. The optical nerves are reflecting it within yourself. The mind is looking within itself. Well, thoughts are rising and falling in that same mind space. Why shouldn't it be possible to include thought in the field of observation? Now, this does not happen easily if you're distracted. And this is why that first principle, one thing at one time with all your heart and soul, is important. It is there that we build focus and concentration. Then, anything else that rises, when you do everything with all of your heart, and your heart's in it, When these thoughts rise, they stand pale because you're doing everything wholeheartedly and you can recognize them and you begin to gradually include thought in the field of observation. What happens as a result? When thought is included as the observable, these impulses don't burst out and go into life. Usually people say, well, I didn't know why I said it or why I did it and I'm sorry. Well, that's a good thing. There's no harm in that, and it's a noble thing to correct ourselves. But as we include thought in the field of observation completely, there will be fewer and fewer of those opportunities, not because we suppress it and try to be politically correct or socially astute, but because thought as an observable is an object, and an object cannot act, it needs to be subject. So it lacks the subject impulse, hence these urges of anger and fear and all of these begin to lose their steam. And all these, my friends, were important lessons that they learned in the old system. Well, the old system is gone, but I'm sure each one can think for themselves and how we can bring this about in our life today. And we're going to get more and more focused as we go along. And towards the end, we'll have an actual layout, an actual program of what we can do, say, in a week or 7 days to help get a good start and reset of the mind. Because you cannot reset the mind. Well, some could, maybe some can, but it is not as easy. Number three, evaluate everything fresh each time. It doesn't matter if that person hurt me yesterday. When that person comes towards me today, it's not that person, it is this person that is coming towards me. Therefore, I respond to what is actually happening and not to memory. By this, my friends, we start dismantling the memory mechanism or how we feel about things. So each one of these may look like very simple principles, but they will give you a lot of mileage, my friends, a lot of mileage. How to evaluate everything, my friends, fresh each time. Do a take two if you have to. Remind yourself if you have to. Okay. Fresh look and evaluate it freshly. Don't allow memory to interfere, not by suppressing memory, but by taking an active interest in what is actually happening each time, like it was the first time. Now, this fourth one is probably the most important, separating thought from action. Do not let situations initiate action, which is do not let thought initiate action. You see something that needs to be done? Do it. Learn to act on its own merit, not because it serves some interest. Your interests, my friends, will get taken care of just the same. They'll get taken care of as a byproduct. Why are we so concerned and afraid or focused on our interests? When you do good things, you'll be taken care of automatically. You do good work, it's sooner or later going to get noticed. So let's actual situations initiate action, not thought, not these impulses. These impulses are all about my interests, what's in it for me, those kind of things. Whether you're at work or the family, something needs to be done. Do it with all of your heart and all of your being. While you're doing it, don't second guess and turn around and look at thought. Are they going to like it? Is it working out all right? Never doubt, my friends. Let the actual situation sustain the action. Actual involvement keep you going. Actual love for action keep you going, not thought. You have to keep thought out of it in the middle too, which is while you're actually doing it. And lastly, when it ends psychologically too. That means when it ends, I'm not thinking about it. And if my mind is now facing wholeheartedly what is in front of its next, it would not be happening. So here's a simple acronym for you, my friends. BDA, before, during, and after. Separate thought from action, BDA. Thought is the medium through which the ego acts. without thought, getting a feeling of subjecthood or assuming you-ness or you, thought is powerless. So by taking an interest, an active interest, and doing things in a sort of alive manner, and these are what these four principles are, one thing at one time with all of your heart. Include thought in the field of observation. This is a little bit difficult, and for this, some of the practices of yoga come in use, come in very handy, especially Japa Yoga, and we'll talk about that next time. Evaluate everything fresh each time. Remind yourself, fresh look, and separate thought from action, BDA, which is before, during, and after. So these simple principles will help take us into an awakened life. An awakened life is a life where we are awake, where habit is not living life. Now, a few of them, like especially including thought in the field of observation and developing concentration, my friends, the spiritual practices are critical for them. And in future sessions, we are going to take up a little bit about the yoga of Shivananda, Swami Shivananda, called the Yoga of Little, where we cultivate the body with asanas and pranayama, learn to do things and cultivate action by karma yoga, which is a means to eradicate selfishness. Devotion, not emotion, true devotion, and we'll talk about that too, cultivating the heart, cultivating the mind, and cultivating wisdom that is beyond academic, living wisdom. These, my friends, we're going to save for another time. Does it sound like a lot? My friends, there are some new facets to cultivate. These will lead to new ways to deal with the same issues, to deal with life, right where we are. Because when how you see things changes, what you see also changes. And we're going to look into these in future sessions. It's not really that much as it seems. Why not stay with it and find out? Every cell has the ability to unfold galaxies as its own. Everything has unlimited potential. If we will only cooperate and participate in its actualizing experience. There is some work to be done, but not all the work. We are eternally partnered with the infinite, and all the infinite can do is what each blessed cell can do, as there is none other. Some closing thoughts, my friends. The doorway to change is in the heart, and its door has two keys, what we think and how we feel about things. Everyone has been given these two keys, but we have other keys too, and there are many rooms. Different rooms open depending on the key used. There are no shortcuts, and by the same token, struggle is optional. Fate and destiny are the effects of our choices, and a bright, healthy, and joyful future is our birthright. Thank you for joining me today. For more information, kindly visit suryadevananda.org.